And he called me back, each person back to a private interview. And he came out and said to me, "You're next." So I was wondering, am I going to get to go back? And he called me back into the private interview room and he said, I had a rosary with me and a quartz egg. It was reticulated quartz that was like a lingam. And I wanted him to bless those items. And first he said, "You worry too much. You worry about the past. You worry about the future. You worry about your family. You worry about your job." He said, "I'll worry about those for you. You worry about the present." And then he pointed his fingers to himself and swept them up and down, and he said, "The omnipresent." So then he looked at the items that I had to bless, and he picked up that reticulated quartz egg, and he said, "This isn't a Shiva Lingam." He said, "I'll make you a real Shiva Lingam tomorrow. Be prepared." We went to the outer interview room, and he saw some other people, and then he passed the vibhuti out to everybody. A handful of vibhuti. He had a little basket full of vibhuti and mm-hmm. packets, and he handed to each person a handful. And I was the last person leaving the room, and somebody had dropped a packet of vibhuti. So I reached down and picked it up, and he was standing behind me looking, and he laughed and said, "You want some more?" Mm-hmm. So I turned around and said, "Sure." So he gave me another big handful of vibhuti packets and went out. And he told me, when he said, "I'm going to make you a real Shiva Lingam," he said, "Be prepared." So I went out with everyone. And that night I was wondering, what does he mean, be prepared? I didn't want to talk to anyone. I just wanted to think about the interview with Swami. And suddenly there was a knock on my door. I was staying right across the street from the gate, main gate. And a English lady, with an English accent, said, "We just got here from Australia. Can my son stay with you?" And I wasn't really that anxious to have guests because I just wanted to be meditative, you know, and contemplate. But I said, "Sure, why not?" And so about 15 minutes later, knock on the door. I expected a 10 or 11-year-old. And there was a 6'5", 250-pound Australian cowboy, her son.
My
cowboy hat, cowboy boots, sleeves rolled up. And I said, "Well, you're welcome to stay here. Come on in." And he laughed and said, "No, I'll just sleep out here on the porch." So he set up a place where he could sleep. And the next morning I was leaving for darshan. He was still asleep. So I woke him up and said, you know, "We need to go over for darshan. Swami's coming out very soon." And I just took off. And sitting there anxious about Swami, said, "Be prepared." I didn't know if he was going to do something there in the crowd or what. So I'd ask somebody to take the camera I had and take a picture if Swami did anything outside. At that time, you could carry a camera. And Swami called me out for an interview, and he said, "Go." So back over to the holding area right outside his home. When I turned the corner to go into that little waiting area with the other devotees who'd been picked for an interview, I saw the Australian cowboy and his mother standing there. Swami had picked them out for an interview. And we went in to the interview room. Swami said something to them immediately. In fact, he was telling the son to obey his mother, and then called him back for a private interview, and they came back out. And then he motioned for me to come forward and hold, give him that reticulated quartz egg. And he took it and held it up for everyone to look at. And he said, "What is this?" And showed it around the room, and no one said a word. He said, "This is glass. It's only glass. I'm going to make a real Shiva Lingam." And he put it in the palm of his hand and held his hand up, palm up, for everybody to see, and then he just blew on it, and it transformed from a reticulated quartz or a clear glass lingam into a solid black Shiva lingam. And then he held it up and said, "This is a real Shiva lingam." He said, "It's made of the five elements." And he looked at me and said, "Who does this belong to?" And I looked up at him and said, "To you, Swami." He smiled and nodded. He pulled a handkerchief out of my pocket, a silk handkerchief I had, and wrapped it up and stuck it in my pocket. He said, "Put it in water every night. It'll help calm your mind." Well, I've been carrying that lingam around. We've been putting it in water every night for 20 years, and I've traveled over 2 million miles in my job-related travel and vacation. So it's here with me today. This is a 20-year mark. It's 1987. It's 2007.
Do you have it here?
Yes, I do.
Right here?
Yeah.
Maybe you can take a look at it.
Okay.
While you're holding it, can I ask you a question? Was the glass piece that you were having of the same size, or is this bigger?
It's. I've been asked that question before. I can't say. It's about the same size, you know. But I've come to the realization, Swami can take things and dissolve them back into the ether.
Oh, yeah, that's no question about it.
Reconstitute it.
You must have heard the story of Hislop's cross.
Yes, I knew him very well.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and I got to hold that cross. Swami reconstituted that from its basic elements. You know, when Swami held it up and showed it to me, he said, "Who does this belong to?" I said, "To you, Swami. This belongs to Swami." Swami had asked me if, "Who does this belong to?" And I said, "To you, Swami," and he nodded and put it in my pocket, you know. So it's on loan. It belongs to him. And every night when we take it out to put it in water, I frequently wonder, is it still in my pocket? Because I know he can reach through space and take
it back.
Since
you mentioned the pocket and all that, would you mind if I narrate a small story?
No, please do.
This happened 1 year, I don't remember the year, early 90s, during a summer course. We used to have summer courses in those days in summer, in the month of May, just before
summer
the
showers?
Summer showers, that's right, just before the college reopened, when all the boys would get orientation in spirituality. And the highlight was a discourse by Swami in the evenings. And he waved his hand and produced a lingam. And then later on, he gave it to the vice chancellor at that time, Mr. Professor Sampath. He said, "Be very careful and don't lose it. It's very precious." He wrapped it in a piece of paper and then put it in his pocket. He said, "Come on, let's go for a drive." Normally what he used to do was get into the car and go in the direction opposite the traffic. The traffic would go towards Bangalore, it would go away so that the crowd melts, and then he would go back to the ashram. This was the discourse was in the college auditorium. And he got into the car, and Professor Sampath was sitting in the front next to the driver, and Swami was at the back. And after they went for some distance, he said, "Sampath, I gave you a lingam. Now I want you to give it back to me." And Professor Sampath put in his hand in his pocket, and then he couldn't find that piece of paper. And he began to sweat like anything. He was muttering and stuttering. He didn't know what to do. He said, "Swami." He said, "What, Swami?" "I want the lingam back. I told you. Didn't you hear me? I'm trying to get that, Swami." "What do you mean you're trying to get that? You have to just pull it out of your pocket and give it to me." "Swami, I think it might have fallen down." So he began to look in the floor of the car and all that. Then Swami said, "You're very careless. I told you it was very precious. What on earth is going on? Why did I make you a vice chancellor?" Of course, he was pulling his leg. And Sampath was just out. And he wished he was probably at the end of the world, somewhere North Pole or South Pole. And then Swami said, "Don't worry, it is too precious to be with you, so I have already taken it away from you." This man finally came back to normal.
Yes,
so
yes.
This has happened. Sometimes he doesn't want it to be with humans. Sometimes he just allows them to look and not touch. So there have been various such instances.
Yes.
Sometimes he gives it away. But with regard to the lingam, I have heard many people being given the same instruction do oblations with water to it and then drink that water.
Yes.
And there is an old student of ours, alumni of the Anantapur College. She is the daughter of a doctor from Sri Lanka who works in our hospital here. And she studied many years ago. She got married to another Sri Lankan. They both settled in New Zealand. course, now he works for the United Nations and he's in Cyprus, but I've been to their house in New Zealand. And Swami had given her a lingam like this. And she used to meditate and, you know, pour water over it and drink it. And this, her husband had a colleague, New Zealander, Kiwi, who had some incurable disease. And he tried everything and nothing worked and he was in frightening pain. He had tried everything and he said, look, I don't know what to do. I want to commit suicide or something like that. He was real desperate. And this man said, well, if you've tried everything, I'll try, suggest one thing. Are you willing to try? He said, I'm ready for anything. I'm desperate. He said, but you must have faith. He said, what's that? I'll give you some water every day. Drink it. Okay, I'll try. And within a week or something like that, the fellow's pain began to go down and pretty soon he got cured because he was, you know, willing to have faith. So many are the stories of that kind. Just
it's wonderful.
Have you had any sort of out-of-the-ordinary experiences on account of this lingam which has saved you from some calamity, catastrophe, danger or whatever?
Well, probably many times I've been saved.
That's right. You know. How about sharing one experience?
Well, I've generally carried this lingam with me wherever I've gone. Like I said, I've traveled more than 2 million miles around the world. And I guess as a result of traveling, I'm exposed to a lot of unstable situations. And I've come through those situations in flying colors. But
traveling with the Navy, you mean?
Well, and in my professional life with the company I worked for. You know, I finally ended up leaving the Navy, and I was actually recruited by a company to head up some very large projects they had to create large hospital information systems. And the ones that I was fortunate to work with and head up, I was a manager for the development of the software, and they'd become the largest hospital information systems in the world today. But as a result of my work in automation, hospital automation, I traveled around the world to briefing some ministries of health about the value of going from manual medical records to automated medical records and the efficiencies that you get as a result of that. But in the process of traveling, you know, you have to go through airports and things. And I did travel through Frankfurt Airport once, and the German police, suddenly put up barricades throughout the airport, searching everyone and all the possessions and giving them a pat down, anything they're carrying. And I generally carry this lingam and in a small pouch around my neck. And so the police were examining me, got to that and said, let's see what is that. And so I took it out slowly and I said, please don't touch. And held it up, and they looked at it closely, you know, squinting their eyes, and they said, okay. So I put it back in a silk handkerchief I carried, put it, and then I kissed it and touched it to my forehead, and they laughed and said, oh, good luck charm. So, you know, to tell you the truth, that's one of the scary events I've had with it and made it through that experience. But Swami is right there saving us all the time. And I was just relating the experience my wife and daughter-in-law had traveling out here, where they were in the Heathrow Airport just last week before on the way. And there was a bomb scare, and they closed down the airport and evacuated 3,000 people, including my wife and daughter-in-law, out to the parking lot. And they subsequently canceled all the flights to Europe and all the long-haul flights. And my wife, Carol, and Suzanne were worried that they were even going to be able to make it to Puttaparthi, or to Bangalore. The flight was to Bangalore. And waiting outside, it started raining, and people started congregating closer and closer to the door of the airport, wanting to get inside. And a man walked up to Carol and Suzanne and said, are you ladies going to Bangalore?
Was that man an Indian?
No. He wasn't. His name was Andy, is what I understand. And they said, yes, we're going to Bangalore. They had been listening very closely for an announcement of their flight. They heard nothing. He walked up and said, are you going to Bangalore? Yes, we're going to Bangalore. So I'm going to Bangalore too. Your flight was just announced. You need to go up to the gate and go through security. So he helped guide them up to the door to go into the security for the security screening. They turned around to thank him, and he had disappeared. They looked for him on the plane when they got on board. He was not on the plane. He didn't fly to Bangalore.
And his job had been done.
Yeah, and his job was done. And I was thinking, Andy, I think he said, Handy. And that's definitely a Swami story. Thank you, Swami. But you know, these miracles happen to us in our daily lives, and sometimes we just take it for granted. Someone, some stranger comes up and helps us out of the blue, and I think those things, Swami is prompting those to happen. And to tell you the truth, I think many times that is Swami.
That is, no question about it. He always says, I come in so many forms.
Yes, yes.
And I am sure you have read the famous story of Tolstoy about Martin the Cobbler. Have you read that? It was one of my favorite stories. There's a cobbler, old Russian cobbler, and it's a cold wintry day. The previous night he had a vision, and Christ says, Martin, tomorrow I'll come. So he's all very anxious to welcome Christ. And first thing that happens, after he gets up in the morning, a little later, a young boy comes hungry, cold, and he gives him some tea and some bread. And then sometimes later, a young lady comes shivering in the cold with a small baby. He accommodates them, makes them sit near the stove, pours out some tea and something else for the kid. And later on, an old man comes. Again, he plays the host, but he's very disappointed. And when he closes the door at night and is preparing to go to bed, he goes near the altar and says, Lord, I was expecting you so eagerly. I was waiting for you. Why didn't you come? And he hears a voice that says, Martin, Martin, I came 3 times. You didn't recognize me? So the Lord does come in many different ways. There's no question about it. It's a beautiful story, but conveys the same truth that Lord comes in many forms, but we don't recognize it.
Yeah, it really is true.
I now want to ask a couple of quick questions before I let you go, as they say in American shows. The first question is, did you have any difficulty in reconciling Swami with all your scientific background? Because, you know, your background trains you for a certain point of view, especially if you come from hardcore physics, which I have also done.
Yeah. Well, let me, can I backstep a little bit to my physics training then? I think Swami helped prepare me for unusual phenomena, or things that are a little bit out of the ordinary, as from a scientific perspective. When I was a graduate student in physics, I was an experimental physicist, and I built pretty much all my own equipment in the shop and blew my own high vacuum glassware and really pretty good at experimental physics. And my major professor came to me one evening and said he had a graduate student coming from China working on a master's degree, or he wanted me to help her set up her equipment for the experiment. So I said, sure, why not? So I met with her, and now, bear in mind, up to that point, if anybody talked about telepathy or ghosts or out of the ordinary sorts of happenings, if any of my colleagues talked about that, I thought they were normal, you know, and then they said that. I thought, maybe they're not that normal. And so this lady said, I want to prove that plants have feelings. Now, as a pure scientist, you can imagine how that struck me. You know, it was very unusual to hear somebody say, you want to prove...
You thought she had gone bananas or something
like
that? Yeah,
I thought, what am I getting into? How did he accept her as a master's degree student? And so I said, well, okay, I'll try to hook up something that if there's any effect, you'll be able to detect it. And so I hooked up some sensitive equipment to the root systems of some plants that she had. And I showed her how to turn everything on and operate the equipment, and I left. And about 2 weeks later, as a graduate student, you know, nights you're working in the laboratory or writing your paper or dissertation. And so I was generally there at nights. Not many people were there except other graduate students working on their PhDs. So I wonder how she's getting on with her experiment. So I went down to her lab where she had the equipment, and I opened the lab up, and nobody was there. So I just turned on the equipment, and I stood on the other side, one side of the room away from the plants, and I said, well, let's see if they have any feelings or emotions. And so I thought to myself, and I thought strongly, I'm going to rip you out of those pots, set you on fire, and throw you out the window. And the needles just went mad. They were oscillating at the extremes, just suddenly. And I tell you the truth, I was very startled about that. And so I thought, well, I wonder if I could replicate that. So I thought, again, I'm going to tear you out of the pots and set you on fire, throw you out the window. And the needles moved a lot less, they say. And then I did it again. The needles didn't move at all. And I was thinking, I wonder if they realize I was bluffing. But that actually made me start thinking that there must be something beyond purely physical.
Have you heard of these experiments of Robert Young in Princeton?
Yes, you know, and also Luther Burbank. You know, I'd read the autobiography of a yogi, and he talks about Luther Burbank. But Luther Burbank was a botanist.
I haven't heard of that one. But
Luther Burbank had some cacti. He put a glass over the cacti, and it had thorns on it. And every day he'd tell the cacti, no one's going to hurt you. You don't have to have your thorns. You can let them go. One day it dropped its thorns, and it created a new genus of cacti, or a species of cacti.
But Robert Young did quantitative experiments.
With plants?
Not plants. You know, you see, he was a professor of aeronautical engineering. Mm. And one of his colleagues was going out on vacation or something. And he said, you take care of my graduate student. And he said, okay, I'll take care of the graduate student. And it was something to do with telekinetic experiments. You know, you have a machine and you try to influence the machine with your mind.
Hmm.
Say, oh, machine behave like this and all. And he thought that was nuts. But he had given his word, and so he helped that student with the equipment and things like that. Because he was a good engineer. Then after a while, he began to get, the student showed results, and he was not prepared to believe it. But anyway, he told him, analyze like this, test for statistical repeatability and so on and so forth. Then he said, let me give it a try. And he had a random number generator, which he would give a normal distribution. And then he had volunteers to go, sort of focusing on the machine, said, no, you don't behave randomly, you don't behave randomly, or something like that. And they began to give distributions that were away from the normal random distribution, Gaussian. And then he said, this can't be true, I don't believe this. So he tightened his controls and so on. Ultimately, he ended up setting up a whole laboratory and spending 2 years, and he even wrote a quantum theory of consciousness, papers on that. He's a Princeton man, and now he's pretty old. And he published some of these in IEEE, which is a peer-reviewed journal. Of course, many people said it's junk science, but you know, he was a thoroughbred Princeton professor, and not to be sneered at.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people who don't want to believe dismissed him.
Sure.
But he did do this, just like Dr. Krukoff, who is in the Durham Medical Center. He had come to Swami. He did some experiments on patients. Of course, it was with controls and all that. And one set of patients would be prayed for in different places, in Jerusalem, in some Buddhist monastery in Tibet, in some groups, Muslim group in Turkey or something like that, and some group in Washington and so on. And they got cured better than another group and so forth. So the long and short of it is there is a possibility of this telepathic this thing. You heard Hislop describe his experience anytime? The saris crying?
Oh, yes.
You heard that?
Yes.
Yes. So that was an extreme case which Swami enacted just to make Hislop realize that even inanimate matter has a bit of consciousness. It's not completely free. But talking of inert matter and everything else that is born out of it, inert matter coming from consciousness, the most powerful statement I read is by George Wald, who got the Nobel Prize for, I think, medicine for his investigations of the eye, something to do with the way the eye works and so forth. And he said, as a scientist, I hate to say it, but I've got to admit that matter is mind stuff. And the human being is the ultimate avatar of the mind stuff, because that's where the consciousness really blooms. I don't remember the exact words, but that was sort of a reluctant acknowledgement by the Harvard Don. He says, you've got to admit it. And all those things, coupled with strong reading of the Bhagavad Gita, did convince me that if you go back far enough, you get to the primordial source of energy, which is the energy of consciousness. And it's rather interesting that Freeman Dyson, whom you must have heard of, you know, he did all this fabulous work in quantum electrodynamics, and then, of course, he sold his soul to the devil, as he described it. Worked in Los Alamos, making the hydrogen bombs very small due to radiation pressure and what have you. He, as a MacArthur fellow, wrote several papers in the Reviews of Modern Physics on life without flesh and blood, consciousness existing all by itself in the universe when the planets become too hostile to support life of this form, as black clouds and so forth. Very serious stuff. Of course, he does a lot of calculations and all that. So when I read all that, and the fact that Schrodinger read Vedanta and believed in the Atma, I felt that there is something much beyond what we normally deal with, and it is too immature to be skeptical about these things.
Yes, I definitely come to believe in the same thing, that if we follow Swami's teachings, we can experience our spirituality more.
What aspect of Swami's teaching appeals to you most?
Well, to love Him above all, and to love our fellow man as ourself. Those are the most meaningful.
There are lots of people who don't believe that love is going to work. This is the age of violence. You see violence everywhere. Yeah. Violence is the only answer to violence.
Well, if you just look at the results, so you can see that that's not true. Violence begets violence.
Supposing somebody asks you, come on, don't tell me that you can transform people with love. What would your reply be?
I'd say that that was hearsay information. I haven't tried it to see if it works.
You know any example where love has triumphed over unreasonableness, at least?
Well, Gandhi, nonviolence and love.
No, anybody you know from a little experience, personal experience? Has Hislop told you of anything, Sandwise, anybody? Hal Horney or anybody?
I know a story of a man. I was talking to Dr. Upadhyaya recently. He's a
eye doctor in UK.
UK. He was saying that he had gone to Bosnia, I believe it was, and they had truckfuls of supplies, medical supplies and other supplies they needed to get to the refugee camps to save their lives. And the problem was that to get the trucks to the camps, they had to drive through hostile territory. There was a high probability that you wouldn't make it. And they couldn't get anyone to drive the trucks. So he said one day a gentleman came to him and as a patient and said that he was at the end of his, he was a wealthy man. He said he was very unhappy, upset, and he was going to commit suicide. That there was no God, there's no reason to live, and so he was going to do himself in. So Dr. Upadhyaya said, could you do me a favor and put that off for 30 days? He said, what do you mean? He said, well, we have a job that's very dangerous. There's a high likelihood that you could become injured or get killed. So driving these medical supplies to these remote locations to help some people in need. We can't get anyone to take those the equipment and the supplies. And he smiled. He said, "Yeah, I'll be glad to do that. I'll do that." So he got in the truck, took off, made it to the villages, started distributing the supplies. The recipients of the supplies were overwhelmed with him being there and just showered love on him. It transformed him. He changed from someone who was ready to throw in the towel because of his anger against himself. And that's what suicide is, the ultimate expression of anger. His anger turned on yourself, and it transformed him into a loving, caring man who believed in a being of divinity. And he's taken those supplies all over that country in hostile territories and become very well known by the authorities. He's one man who can go anywhere in that country.
You mean he keeps on doing it?
He keeps on doing it. And the people in charge, even though they disagree with each other, they see the need to help their own. And so they allow him to come in and do his work. So I think that's an expression of those people's love to him transformed him. I think that can happen, too, in a bigger scheme or a bigger realm. You know, that when you have an outpouring of love, that love transforms whoever you're interacting with or wherever you're interacting. Just off the top of my head, it's hard for me to think of some examples right now.
No, but this is a very interesting thing. The man who wanted to end his life, put it off, took to loving service, and has changed his life.
Yeah. So, the people who he met changed his life.
That's a very striking example. I wish we could get more people to know about these things and turn away from desperation to something more constructive and positive. And if more people become oriented towards positive work and positive thinking and they connect, then there can be a groundswell and that can produce a change. So that's a very nice thing to hear.
Well, you know, just as Swami teaches that unfulfilled desires result in frustration and anger.
That's absolutely true.
And the dissatisfaction of desires never brings true happiness, especially in the material world. That a desire, in my experience, the more that I get, the harder it is for me to keep everything repaired.
That's true.
So I'm saying, like Swami said, the lighter the luggage, the more pleasant the trip. So I'm trying to thin down and live simply. It's a lot happier life.
Once I went with Swami to Bombay, and the host, they gave all of us small briefcase-like thing, and Swami handed it out to all the people in the party. And there were about 6 or 7 of us. I was one of them. Then I looked at Swami and said, "Swami," he said, "less luggage and you're giving me luggage." He said, "I didn't mean this kind of luggage." Because he wanted to get rid of it and give it to me. So he said, "I didn't mean this luggage." That was a good one. So I would like to thank you. I've kept you here for more than an hour almost.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
It's a pleasure. And your son is missing. Next time we'll have all three of you.
Yeah, you know, he was in summer showers in 95, and he has a lot to talk about.
Yeah, we'll take a shot at you, not with a gun, but with our cameras, and not just the microphone.
Oh, okay.
All three of you.
You said you wanted to prepare.
You have 6 or 7 months to prepare your notes.
All right. We'll do that. Anyway, thank you so much.
And get ready for a stiff examination.
Thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure being here.
No, it's my pleasure. You're going on Wednesday?
We're going back
to San Diego.
Yeah, we're going to.
Where do you live now? In Texas?
We live in California.
California.
And Southern California. President of Region 8 there, which is Nevada, Southern California, and Hawaii.
Oh, that's very nice.
So
you go often to Hawaii whenever you feel like having it.
I've been telling all of the regional officers we need to take a trip over there to visit the centers. But, it's been my blessing to have that job and work in Swami's organization. So we're going to go, though, when we leave here, we're going to meet our parents-in-law in Italy.
Oh.
And perhaps we'll see some side devotees.
Which place in Italy?
Rome, and then Florence, and Venice, and then back to the States.
Well, have a nice trip back home.
Thanks.
And thanks for spending some time with us.
I look forward to seeing you when we get back during Christmas.
Thank you.
Sairam.